Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, everybody, let's hang tight and look for landing radar.
Flight guidance.
No guidance.
We'll need that landing radar by 18,000 with this soundtrack.
Roger.
On the pings.
Roger, copy guidance. Okay, we got data back.
Radar flight looks good.
Roger.
2,000 feet.
Roger. 2,000 foot delta H. Your gun goes based on the data you have for an LOS. I see we got it back. Give you another few seconds.
We're going fine.
Okay, retro.
Go.
Fido.
Go.
Guide.
Go.
Control.
Go.
Telcom.
Go.
GNC.
Go.
Ecom.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Capcom. We're go to continue. PDI.
Coming to you live from the slopes of the ghost-filled Sierra Nevada gold country and in the paranormally active shadow of Mount Rainier, it's Ghost Rider Paranormal Radio with your hosts, John Almada and Kat Lang.
Show number 4. We are here.
Yay!
It's John and Kat. And,
hi.
Hi, sweetheart. How are you?
Hi. I'm good. You?
Oh, it's been an active day. Of course, you've been talking to me all day, so.
Yeah, I know. I tend to talk to you all day, most of the day, so.
Yeah, well, we've discovered the wonders of Skype, and for those who don't know what that is, it's a really interesting internet phone service, and it's right now I'm looking at it. How many people are on right now? 7 million.
Are we still up in the millions?
Yeah, this morning it was 13 million. Now they're down to just 7,500,000 on there all at one time. I don't know how they do it, but it's just amazing. But anyway, tonight is going to be basically it's you and me.
That's it.
Yeah. And what we have on tap for tonight is debunk night and some discussions about UFOs. So what is debunk night? Well, for our 90 minutes, the first half hour, we're going to basically discuss, debunking scenarios that we've both run into in our travels as we have investigated various haunted locales. And during the second half hour, we'll continue some of that discussion and then get into some of the techniques that each of us has used for debunking. And on our third half hour, the special surprise was going to be UFO discussions, just kind of a free-for-all discussion about our individual thoughts about UFOs. Probably I'll pull up some news information about the UFO that was spotted over the Obama inauguration and make some guesses as to what that might have been. Were you aware about that, Kat?
Yeah, I saw that on that video. Very interesting.
Yeah, considering that the airspace was locked down tighter than a drum, it's amazing something like that got by. And I'm sure the U.S. Air Force and a lot of other security agencies were not too happy to see that.
Well, you
happen.
Can't really lock the aliens out. I mean, you know.
Yeah, well, they probably were making their presence known, but. Okay, let's talk about debunking. What is it? Why do we do it? In the whole world of paranormal investigation. Well, when we walk into a client's case and they are talking to us about what they think they're experiencing, there's often the case is that we need to go in and pre-investigate and look around and see what could possibly explain the phenomena that's being talked about. And oftentimes it turns out to be, rather mundane things, and sometimes it doesn't. It turns out that there's, a little more, there's something that's just so off the wall that no one would have guessed is happening that it takes a paranormal investigator and potentially somebody, like a plumber, oddly enough, taps comes to mind, people with special training to look for these things. And so when we outfit our toolkits and the things that we have, for example, with EMF meters And we're, you know, using our eyes and their ears and senses to really take an objective look at what's going on and seeing it as outsiders. That's, you know, really the best form of debunking there is. So, you know, that said, you know, let's talk about some of the cases that we've run into. I have not done as many probably private cases as you have, Kat.
Right.
But what I have had the opportunity to do has been mostly with regard to, you know, EVPs, where we've really had some question as to what we've picked up in the field. And it takes kind of an after case debunking. You know, you're really looking at the evidence and saying, you know, is this what I really think it is? And EVPs are kind of a tough thing because you really have to be sure of what you had when you were out in the field, what was happening at that moment in time. And I've kind of learned as I've gone along with this, I mean, there's no rule book or very few rule books that tell you how, you know, every in and out of EVP technique and capture and that kind of thing, what to do in the field and best practices. And you pick it up as you go.
Right.
And I had one that was pretty interesting. We were at a cemetery down in the just to the east of Sacramento, and I can't remember the name of it. I think it's called Michigan Bar. And I had a case where we did an hour and a half investigation with a local paranormal group. And when I came back and was doing my evidence analysis, I suddenly realized that there was something that I thought for the life of me was truly paranormal. And I almost went live with it. I almost put it out on the site as, you know, a quote, an EVP. But I thought, you know, there's just something not right about this. And so I went ahead and contacted, you know, the other members of the team and said, hey, this thing is awfully interesting. And do you think that this is potentially paranormal? And before I go on with the story, I'll just go ahead and play it, which here we go. And I call it the White Rum EVP, and it's it was really a great teaching tool for me because it taught me to be really skeptical of what I'm picking up out there. So here we go.
Last time I was here, there were many spirits visiting with a light orb. I'm wondering if you guys
now, were you able to hear that, Kat?
Yeah, I can hear. I could hear the part about the white rum.
Yeah, it was extremely disturbing when you listen to it, you know, with headphones on and really are, you know, picking up everything being said. You could hear this woman's voice, and the emotion in the voice was just amazing. You know, you had the feeling there was, you know, this was actually a spirit speaking and wandering through, you know, that particular cemetery at night. I had placed the drop recorder on an actual headstone in this in the Michigan Bar Cemetery, which is an abandoned cemetery that very few people actually know about, and they drive right by it and no one sees it. So we had the, you know, this equipment all set up. I had video on one set of plots. I had this my Sony, you know, trusty Sony ICD sitting on top of this other gravestone. And when I came back and, you know, analyzed this, of course, it really seemed to be, you know, a really good EVP. I mean, you know, Class A all the way. And I went ahead and contacted the group, and it turned out that one of the investigators was just going a little bit crazy, and she basically was just reciting bits of history, trying to get the spirits to actually speak, you know. And evidently there was something about white rum in that location. Maybe they were making rum in the area. But it was extremely, you know, just almost heartbreaking to see that actually come out. as, you know, you think you've got a really good capture, and you find out it's not what you thought it was. That said, on a private investigation, you know, front, let's talk about some of your cases and, you know, what you have had experience with in the past where you've debunked, you know, walked into a case you thought for sure was going to be, you know, a paranormal activity, and then you find out it's something else.
Well, we did a case a couple years ago. Actually, a coworker of mine's ex-wife was having some disturbances in the house that she was renting out with her kids. And he had phoned me one night and asked me if I could get in contact with her, and I did. And we sat down, and we met at a restaurant here in town, and she brought, she'd recorded some, what she thought were EVPs, and I listened to them, and I thought it sounded kind of interesting, so we had arranged to go to her house and do a walkthrough and maybe, you know, basically start the case up, take some control shots, and then maybe set up a time to come back and do an actual, you know, down-earth hardcore investigation of this place. And it was discovered upon arrival to this house that it was full of black mold.
Ooh.
And it wasn't, it wasn't really about it was debunking what she had recorded, but what was also discovered was that her children had some friends over and thought it would be funny to start doing these potential EVP recordings and didn't tell her that it was really them doing it. And so with the combination of the black mold and her kids just trying to pull a prank, we pretty much didn't go back for a full-scale investigation. We pretty much knew what was going on in the home. There's a bunch of pictures taken of all this black mold, and the recommendation to her was that she get her and her kids out of this god-awful house and move to a different location, because things like black mold can really alter your psychological state and cause you, just like a if you have an old fuse box that puts out a great deal of just wasted power, you can have these hallucinations. So we narrowed it down to those two factors, and the formal investigation really didn't go off.
Yeah, that brings up another good point. I mean, the whole question of, you know, power boxes, which often, you know, you see people with basements who are usually going down to do, of all things, the wash, you know, that kind of thing. You see that all the time on taps, and I think it's the East Coast and middle part of the U.S., you know, tend to have that more than we have out here in the West. But, you know, you tend to see that with the power boxes in some of these old houses. You know, they go in, and essentially it's, you know, the classic fear cage, where they go in, and that's another, you know, big warning sign when you walk in.
Right. Well, you know, and even if you do that, you're still helping the client by at least pointing this out to them, because that's a real fire hazard. We did a case here about a year and a half ago. We did an old theater out here, and we had discovered bare and open wiring that we pointed out to the managers of this place, and they were not aware of it.
Yeah, that brings up the aspect of danger, you know, when you're doing investigations, is walking into a place and basically you need to be ready for anything, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you've actually, I take it, have had more dangerous, you know, investigations where you've walked into this kind of thing. I've done some evening work and been able to, you know, see, you know, it was going to be a safety issue and bring flashlights and that kind of thing. But when you're walking into the unknown, and truly into the unknown, it's, you know, an issue.
Right.
What other cases have you had that just come to mind that strike you, that had things that just turned up? You know, you've obviously found, you know, basically almost a fakery going on. What other, you know, what other things have happened?
I was in on a case here a few years back up north of me there was a gentleman and his wife who thought that they had demonic possessions going on in the home, that his face was changing, and it had actually turned out to a high level of energy coming out of various places in the home that were causing these disturbances. We got high EMF spikes. And as you go on these investigations, you learn that if you get these high energy spikes at certain parts of the home, and if like what we were just talking about, if there's a fuse box nearby, you can almost guarantee that there's something wrong with that fuse box. And that's part of the debunking process. But these people were literally frightened of their own home. And so we went in and did an investigation and then sat down with the clients and let them know what we had found, and that we suggested that they get an electrician in there to take a look at their wiring in their home.
Yeah, I had the same case type of cases where we've walked into places that were, you know, supposedly haunted in the town of Placerville, and that's about 9 miles north of me.
Right.
I won't name the places, but these were, you know, depicted to be well-known established haunts. And when we got in there with EMF meters, it was very easy to find that the wiring in many of these places was a little bit shaky. It's not saying that there isn't paranormal activity. I don't want to rule that out, and I'm sure there is some. But, you know, the question, you know, is can you reliably go in there and say, just on the basis of, oh, I'm picking up, you know, these readings, you know, that there is something going on there, and you really can't. And I had to go back in and tell the owner, the person that was, you know, in this building that in question, that, hey, you've got a wiring issue, and you needed to look into this. And they really didn't understand, and I, you know, explained basically what we've been talking about. And time after time, when you walk throughout, you know, all these old Western, you know, towns that have, you know, building after building that's like this, it probably knocks out at least I'd say 50%,
right,
that are just going to be either a fear cage effect or something that's going to be, you know, completely explainable as an EMF sensitivity,
right,
that people are going to have.
Well, we did have activity in this home. We did have some paranormal activity that we had gotten on film, and we'd also gotten a few EVPs, but for the most part, we found an electrical-type disturbance that probably was causing most of the fear and the hallucinations. So, you know, and I also want to say, you know, living up here by Mount Rainier, we get a lot of tremors.
Yeah.
And I've had people contact me and say, oh, my God, things are moving in my house. Please come over and tell me why. You know, so I'll go over there, and there's maybe a glass. I have things on my fireplace mantle myself that will do the same thing. It'll move a little bit at a time. But if you have something sitting like up on the fireplace mantle and you don't look at it for a couple of years, and then you go, you know, to maybe move it or something, and you see that it's moved, some people freak out, but it's because of the tremors that we have. I can feel them. Objects will move very slowly by themselves.
Yeah.
So I talked to one lady here in our complex, in fact, and she kind of looked at me with, like, she had egg on her face, and she said, oh, no, I'm sorry. And I said, no, it's okay. That's my job. I'm performing a public service by working with you on this and letting you know that there aren't things here in your home. It's just natural movement from the tremors we get from Rainier.
Yeah, you know, and that's the value that paranormal groups do, especially, you know, really ethical ones. They're not out for the glamour and glory. They're out to really say something about what's really happening and put people's minds, you know, at ease, because hauntings are, you know, they're all over, and that's an established fact of life. And we've all seen that. I mean, you've been on cases where extraordinary things have happened. I've seen things that just, you know, are mind-blowing. But most of the universe is pretty mundane.
Oh, yeah.
And
I have clients that I have spoken with over even this past year that I've talked to people, and the first question, of course, they always ask is, are you like TAPS? And I'm like, yeah, well, we have the equipment like TAPS, but for the most part, these investigations, like you say, are rather mundane. You sit for hours staring at a laptop screen with cameras set up, just staring at it, just nothing really. But, you know, for a lot of clients, it really makes them feel good to know that there's a group of people that will come into their home, set up all this equipment, and stay up all freaking night for them to make sure that their home is secure. That in itself is speaks volumes to people that don't do this for a living or a hobby.
Well, that was like the case where TAPS actually went in and found that little boy who claimed that he was sleeping and not creating any problems, and his sister kept waking up and swearing somebody was touching her and doing things, and then
right. The
family would come in and the son would be asleep on the top bunk. Well, it turned out that kid was basically sleepwalking, the young man in the top bunk, and was getting down, and they had it all on video. So, you know, there you never know what you're going to catch on these investigations. And one thing that I did just the other night, well, I was actually talking to you on the phone, and I was testing out one of my new cameras. I had a new infrared camera, and I hooked it up, and I hooked up to my television set, just a direct feed. It was just convenient, and I grabbed an RCA patch cord and hooked the thing up and was surprised to start seeing things floating by, and
right.
that things that you would have not have thought were there. You would look, and there was nothing there, and yet here on the camera was showing up what looked like ghostly activity, and then I realized it was dust, and quite a bit of it,
uh-huh.
you know, floating through. And I had a fan on in the room, and so it was blowing this stuff around. And it turned out in close proximity to the infrared camera, we were seeing these you know, floating apparitions, if you will. And I can't tell you the number of sites that actually have had that as evidence posted up on their website. It boggles the mind, you know, why they would even put those things up. So I think one of the areas that I was aware of that in the past, but it was a good reminder, is that you look at some of these older places and you have to factor in, you know, are they basically, you know, relatively clean? Is there a lot of dust around that could cause artifacts? And that, you know, it was just a great, you know, reminder. So, you know, it's just when you go out there, you're going to see so much of this. It's not even funny. And yeah, go ahead.
You know, we touched on something just a little while ago before the show. We were talking that I just wanted to make sure that I brought this up because I think it's very important. You know, we talked about different types of equipment that we use out in the field, and to get a good digital recorder, you can spend anywhere from, you know, $80 to $120 on a really good one. But the other thing that you need to remember is how sensitive this equipment is.
Oh yeah.
So if you want to go into that for just a second with that music, that would be great.
Yeah, we're coming up on 25 past the hour here in just about 1 minute, and we'll be
That's right.
We'll be doing our little tingle break and
things to come, my friend, things to come.
Yeah, but go ahead while we got that brief moment.
Well, I was just going to say that when we're out in the field, now some of these digital recorders are very sensitive, and they can pick up a variety of noises that aren't paranormal in nature, such as music, or even I've heard fire trucks from, like, you know, 2-3 miles away, or leaves crunching from, like, you know, 50 yards away. Just some of this equipment is extremely, extremely sensitive to outbound sounds. So when you purchase these, if you get, like, you know, even the lower priced ones can be really good too. But you want to make sure that you test these things out to make sure that the sound range, so that you can, you're not sitting there for hours trying to figure out what this noise is when it's probably not paranormal if your equipment is that sensitive.
Well, that's a good point, and I'll tell you what, we'll go ahead and go on with that right after the break.
Okay.
Talk about some of that. So I'm going to take a brief moment here to say that I selected our music tonight with a kind of an eye towards folks that are really kind of thinking hard about everything going on in the world right now, especially with the economy the way it is and all these strange events, and everyone is, you know, kind of looking at things negatively. And I wanted to pick a song that I thought would kind of brighten people up a little bit and make them remember that, for the most part, life is good. You know, and the fact that we're here talking about it, you know, and able to go out and hunt for ghosts and do the things we do, we're all still in here, we're all still in this together. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and kick on our break music. And I'm going to put it at 70% just so I can make sure everybody can hear it. And we'll be back in roughly 4 to 5 minutes.
That's right.
Okay.
When you're feeling lonely, lost and let down, seems like those dark skies are following you around, and life's just one big shade of gray. You wonder if you'll see the light of day behind the clouds. The sun is shining. Behind the clouds, yeah, there's a big blue sky.
And things are a little bit brighter in the world.
That's right.
Well, before we get going on the sensitivity of equipment, I'll take a brief side turn here and read a couple of headlines from not necessarily paranormal news, but things that I thought were kind of funny. In the news today from Fox News on the Associated Press, there is the headline that John the Toilet was shot and laid to rest in Centerville, Utah. John, a porcelain commode gunned down in an accidental shooting at a fast food restaurant's bathroom, has died. His age was not immediately known. The toilet was shattered by a bullet on January 12th when a man's gun fell from its holster as he was pulling up his pants, police said. Police do not intend to file criminal charges in connection with the incident. Christian Martinez, manager of the Carl's Jr. where John was gunned down, held a memorial service Friday at the restaurant. He gave away bottles of John's favorite toilet cleaner, Kaboom Bowl Blaster, to the eatery's first 50 patrons. A bountiful flower shop provided a large floral arrangement. Quote, in all my years, I can say without a doubt that I have never delivered for a toilet, said delivery man Doug Graham, but I thought it was the funniest thing I've ever heard of, and I got a kick out of it. Remnants of John hit and cut the gun owner's arm, but he was not seriously injured. Police blamed John's death on the gun and style of holster the man was using. Quote, he was survived by the men's urinal and wash sink, said Martinez. He left us way too soon. Okay, and let's go on to some more paranormal news. I just couldn't resist. I saw that before the show. You're snorting. You snorted again.
Sorry.
God, hon, I'm really cracking you up tonight.
Listen.
He left us way too soon. Oh, God, I can see the investigation now, the toilet that might have been.
I think that was probably a really crappy experience.
Oh, God. I can see the EVP of the bathroom. Oh, my God.
Nice.
Well, let's move on to actual paranormal events. What we have here is from the Journal Enquirer of North Central Connecticut. It's a local story. Investigators, spirits present at the Cheney homestead, where they probably don't shoot toilets. But evidently, Manchester, hyphen, here we go. Paranormal investigators Michael Krause and Cindy Cabell have spent the past few months investigating the Cheney homestead, and they say that there are spirits present. Timothy Cheney, a farmer, miller, and one of America's famous clockmakers, built the homestead around 1785. Krause said that he and Cabell would go into a place and try to disprove all accounts, and their work is based on scientific evidence, and they do not charge for investigations, which is, you know, a highly ethical group. More power to them. Krause founded Eastern Connecticut Paranormal 11 years ago. He says that he's been investigating for long enough that he can tell if someone is just hearing a banging pipe or floorboard shifting due to temperature changes, which, you know, we've all run into that. This was far from what the two found at the homestead, they say. Their video camera picked up moving lights in the parlor above the bed the Cheneys used to hold wakes for their family members. And when the investigators asked if there was anything there, the lights would start moving in all directions. In addition, there were several photographs taken in the same room showed beams of light that resembled a laser pointer. These lights are visible on camera, but the two investigators did not see them. That was because the camera is 400 times quicker than the human eye in picking these things up. In the former bedroom of the Electra Woodbridge Cheney, Timothy Cheney's daughter-in-law and mother of the Cheney brothers who founded the family's silk mills, Krause asked if anyone was there, and a voice recorder picked up the sounds of a male voice saying something like, I am the older one. The voice sounds muffled in distance, and Krause said he didn't hear the voice during the investigation, only on the recording. And this is known as an electronic voice phenomena, or EVP. And it goes on, you know, but it's just out there, lots and lots of this kind of news. We'll pick up one more, and actually our public service announcement for the day, our good deed. The good folks who run the USS Salem over in Massachusetts are a group that have taken over one of America's oldest battleships, And actually, you know, I'll probably be picked on real hard if I don't clarify that that is not quite a battleship, but it's a really big ship. That said, it's Massachusetts Paranormal and Nightfall Paranormal will hold four fundraisers for the USS Salem this year. The events are scheduled for April 10th, May 15th, June 19th, and July 31st from 7 p.m. to 3 a.m. And they're going to basically, the Massachusetts Paranormal and Nightfall Paranormal folks are going to, you know, demonstrate investigation techniques, and they will conduct that investigation on the ship. And the cost is going to be about $85 a person, which is a bargain. You know, when you're used to paying over $200 for some of the stuff we do here on the West Coast. And it's going to include meeting with the guests, coffee, water, snacks, sandwiches. And participants have to be at least 16 years old, and anyone under 18 must be accompanied by an adult. And if you just go out and look at, on the USS Salem website, you'll see everything you need to. Or go out to www.massparanormal.net. And so that's our public service announcement.
Yeah, it's a shame the economy is the way it is right now. People just don't have any extra money.
Yeah, well, you know, I forked out just to do the Clovis Sanitarium. I forked out, you know, well over $200.
Right.
I had to drive the 200 miles on top of that, and the hotel and everything, and it adds up. Let's see.
It does. Yeah, we shell out quite a bit for, you know, a lot of the places around here that people like to investigate now are starting to cash in on the fact that they may be a little bit haunted, so they start charging groups to investigate. So it gets a little spendy after a while.
Well, what's funny is, you know, you don't have to look too far. I mean, just go out to the oldest part of town or head to the old cemetery. You know, you don't have to go to, you know, if you're really interested in this and you want to do this in today's economy, you can still do it on a shoestring. And
sure. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I can't tell you the amount of Craigslist stuff that's sitting here powering the studio right now that I'm in, but it is possible. And you can go out and do, you know, become an expert on the history of your area. You know, because, like, for example, here we are in the gold country of California, where, you know, 9 miles from here is where John Sutter and Marshall discovered the gold.
Right.
Or of the 1849 gold rush, which, you know, lit up the whole west coast of this, you know, of the country from, you know, here all the way up to where you're at near Seattle.
That's right.
And it just, you know, people were, you know, coming in droves. So there's a lot of history here, and all you have to do is pick up and just start learning and go talk to some of the folks downtown. Go, you know, make it your business to know everything there is to know about some of these things, and talk to old folks, and they'll tell you things that you won't believe. So yeah, it's amazing. But you know, it's really nice to see though those folks on the East Coast are kind of getting the message and bringing the price down within reason. But, you know, $85 is about right.
$85 is a bargain for doing something like that. That's pretty neat.
Well, we'll have the final story here from our foreign news desk here at Ghost Rider Paranormal.
Our foreign news desk. Delete.
Here, we have this coming straight from the British Broadcasting Center, BBC.
The BBC.
BBC, oh, yes. The headline is, I dare say, oh boy, ghost tales spook hospital staff. It's not proper to spook them, is it? This is Derby.
Nice try, John.
Yes, it was nice try, yes. Chip, cheerio. Derby's new super hospital is making a chaplain available following reports of a ghostly figure in the building. Now, it probably was the economy going away. But staff at Derby Central General Hospital, where a $334 million pound, I say dollar and it's pound, $334 pound, like it's that heavy, building project is ongoing, having reportedly seen a mysterious apparition in the building. Managers said they took information from the staff seriously and were working with the chaplaincy to ease fears, but they denied any suggestion that an exorcism or similar ceremony was being planned for the hospital. The Reverend Elaine Jones, an advisor to the Bishop of Derby on the paranormal, said she has been asked to visit and investigate the claims. And what it turns out to be is this hospital was built on the remains of the older hospital.
Right.
And it would appear that perhaps some of the folks who passed on in the old hospital have some strong feelings about the rebuilding effort, I guess. It seems to accompany construction projects. So, yes, our British friends are having a fun time with their hospitals. And it was funny, I was talking, of all things, with my mother about hauntings in hospitals, and it turned out that when, you know, it, as you well know, my father had a stroke a couple of years ago, and we've had times back and forth going to the hospital for seizures and things like that. And we got onto the subject of the work that I do, going out on investigations, and my mother was talking with a nurse about it after I had left, and the nurse pulled my mother aside and says, we have a lot of things that go on up here. And, and my mother said, well, what do you mean? She goes, we won't go in the lower basement. And my mother says, well, why? And she goes, they see things. And she says, you will not believe the things we see in this place. And other hospitals have the same issue. So when it really comes down to it, if you can somehow wangle your way into a hospital that's still going and is still a going concern, or, you know, has been closed up and is still accessible, I'm sure you'll find quite a bit of stuff going on. You know, I'm sure.
Yeah, we have HIPAA laws up here in Washington State that prohibit us from doing things like that. But certainly an abandoned hospital might be the way to go.
Yeah, I tend to think, yeah, the HIPAA, I don't know. I don't think that they had paranormal provisions. That's actually a good idea for a show, paranormal law. You know, I mean, is there going to be a issue with talking to the dead who are, you know, what are their privacy rights? I never thought about that.
It's us versus them.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I'm sure that
I read that article that you were just talking about. In fact, I watched a little video clip that you'd provided, and I think that the term exorcism is a little strong for what they're actually dealing with at that hospital.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be more mundane that, you know, these spirits are probably confused why everything changed around. You know, it has to be something along those lines that...
Well, if it's just an old guy wandering around the halls in a gown, let him do it.
Yeah, but I think it upsets the kids.
I don't know.
You really have to think about that. I mean, you know, imagine you're walking in. Here you are. And, I guess in Britain, they have, you know, socialized medicine. So here are all these people who've waited for months to get into the hospital. They're standing there waiting their turn. You know, that hopefully they're not dying on the vine because of the great socialized medicine. But they're waiting on the vine to get in, and suddenly an apparition walks by with its behind exposed in a phantom hospital gown.
Well, that's encouraging.
Oh, God, help me not be that way when I finally pass.
That's right.
Do something more, you know, grandiose. Anyway, news be done. And we were talking about all the wonderful things that happen when you buy really expensive, you know, paranormal investigation equipment. And so take it away. What we were on that part, and you had the last word on that.
Right. You know, when you buy equipment, you normally would get some information about it. And if you're going to use it for EVP work in a paranormal investigation, you should probably, instead of just pulling it out of the package and slipping a chip in it or whatever you're going to do and throwing the battery and turning it on, you should probably do a little bit of research on it. It might save you a lot of time and a lot of effort to be able yourself to decipher between maybe this is a voice and this is like a tree that's just rustling like 50 yards away. Certainly when you do a cemetery, cemeteries are creepy enough.
Yeah,
you know, they can make your mind play tricks on you, especially if you're out there and it's super quiet and all of a sudden something can be totally natural in occurrence can make a noise, and some people really get kind of flipped out about it. So you just want to make sure that you understand the equipment that you're using and what it's capable of picking up or seeing for you if it's a video camera.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you need to be able to you know, fully explore and know the potentials of the equipment, you know, from the moment you go out in the field and are collecting evidence and what it sounds like when you get back or what you're viewing. So it's absolutely essential.
And it's also really important to realize when you're going out with your team that if you have, like what you picked up, it's natural, I think. I know it is for me, and I probably have the worst habit of it of anybody I know, of going to an investigation and going into a residence and whispering.
Yes, that's a very good one.
So if you cough, if you sneeze, if you're going to whisper, if you bump into something, you just say, "That was me," or "That was so-and-so just whistled," or "That was so-and-so just bumped a cabinet." Just try to identify what it is. If it's a noise that you're conscious of that somebody, that is man-made, like bumping into a table, you announce it on the recorders so that you can immediately take that off of your plate as far as, is this paranormal or is it not?
Yeah. And even when you do get things that it's like what we had with that earlier EVP I played, where you're just not sure, you know.
Right.
It makes sense to go in and really, you know, put it through the acid test and really be sure. Now, I've got another one here like that. I'll go ahead and just play it.
Okay.
And this is from the Bailey House up. We've had evidence from that particular place on before, but we're going to play this. And then I'll tell you what this really was about.
It's your girl. I just shot it out.
Oh, man.
Now, you heard that. It was a male voice, and then there was a female response.
Right.
That was actually us looking at the remains of a bell that was in the servants' quarters near the kitchen. And the guy who was fixing up the place tells us about this bell, and we look at it, and I mention, hey, we ought to get a shot of that. And it was picked up on the recorder. Well, when I was listening back, I didn't remember that conversation. And when I heard the woman's voice, we had been picking up earlier in my analysis of the EVPs, I was picking up a woman's voice, so I didn't remember her responding like that. And so it was just a great idea to check, you know, that we were, you know, it was indeed just human activity and not, you know, mundane. But it's surprising how the equipment will fool you, you know, between that and cameras where you pick up things just like what I said before, where we are seeing the dust and things float by that, you know, really isn't evidence, but some groups and some folks do post it as that and do not appreciate how easy it is to, you know, get artifacts like that.
Right. It saves you a lot of time in evidence analysis. You and I both know it, in analyzing all this evidence. It would save you a lot of time if you can pre-identify noises that are man-made or that you make or you just whispered, especially when you get like 8 or 9 of these recorders going. That's a lot of evidence to go over.
It is an embarrassment of riches often when you get back and you realize, oh, my God, I've got a ton of evidence to analyze. And I've still got cases that, you know, I've done about 70% of this and that, and I know I got to get back to it, but I've got, you know, X number of things planned, and I got a new investigation going on, so you really have to dig the time. I'm learning really to tone down the amount of evidence I collect. I think it's wise to, you know, limit investigations to, you know, less than 6 hours at the maximum, unless there's
right.
some really prevailing reason to stay there for longer, because you're just going to get just slammed. And you know, I've been flying GRI alone for quite a long time, and now the groups are, you know, I'm starting to get members, and here you are in it, and you've done
right.
work with me, and it's great to have team members in there that really know what they're doing. Really,
well, if you see, so, you know, you do day investigations mostly.
Yeah, I do.
So you rely a lot on the EVP work. So you and your and everybody else on the team, you know, like I say, the more of the evidence, recorded evidence, that you can identify as man-made, just the easier it is.
Yeah, it truly is, and we already have an embarrassment of really good evidence. You know, I've just run into so much.
Right.
And posted it on the website, the things that we have picked up. I did the top 10 from 2008 that's on the GRI site.
Yep.
That has just some of the very best stuff that, you know, any group would be happy to have this. So you really can throw out an awful lot. And when in doubt, throw it out. You know, that's the rule. It just, you know, if you can't defend it, then it's not worth it. And that's the
right.
point. That's the total point of it all. Oh, my goodness. Let me see where we're at in the show here. I've got to look at the time. Oh, we're doing just fine. Well, investigations are, it's interesting. When you go out to do an investigation, let's talk technique. One of the first things I do on my day investigations when I get to a site is I do a sweep. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know quite how your group was doing it. But I actually just do a quick walkthrough and look things over and look for anything that jumps out at me. And I just have a simple notepad. And I'm just looking around, getting the lay of the place, writing down what the person is telling me who's taking me through. Or if no one's there, I'm just jotting down anything that looks strange or catches my eye.
Right.
And I take a EMF meter with me, an EVP, and I just do spot checks. And I tend to get back and analyze that real quick and see, is there anything that's jumping out at me? And when you get back, then you spend some time and really, you know, weigh, is there anything that can explain what's going on here? You know, process is super easy, and a lot of groups don't do that. They just dive right in.
Well, since I'm a case manager, I can tell you exactly what I do. I'm usually the one that goes and interviews the client. I will, if we have time right then and there, especially if it's residential, I will do a quick walkthrough of the home. When I arrive at the home, I have a notepad, just as you do. I'll usually bring a camera. I don't bring an EMF meter with me, per se. All I really have to go on is what the homeowner has initially called me and informed me of what's going on in the home. I'll do an initial walkthrough with the homeowner, and I will ask them to point out, where did you see this thing, or where did you hear it? You have a cold spot. Where is it? Where did you feel it? Do you feel it every day? I'll just get some general notes down that I can bring back to the group where we can discuss the ins and outs of this particular investigation. So during the initial walkthrough, it's the informative stage, but it's where you want to pay the closest attention to the homeowner and or business owner, because they're the ones that are leading you through this, so you gain the information that you get. Also, initial contact is very important in establishing a rapport with this individual. So after that, take some baseline readings. That's where I'll take my control shots, and I will present those to the group, and then we will set up a time to go in. If my founders want to do another walkthrough, we'll arrange for them to, and sometimes I'll go with them, and sometimes I'll stay back and let them do a walkthrough, and then we'll arrange for a formal investigation. And then usually as a case manager, what I will do is when the homeowner is present during the investigation, and I will be with the homeowner the whole time, kind of answering questions, explaining what's going on, explaining what everybody's doing. It seems to, I should say about 98% of the time, it calms the homeowner down to calm their fears and just reinforce and let them know that we're there to figure out what's going on in their house. And generally it makes them feel quite comfortable. We just go sit in another room and have some coffee and just chit chat maybe. But I'm the one that will answer all of their questions so that they're not wandering around the home.
That's exactly what happened when I investigated at the St. George in Volcano.
Right.
Patriot Hotel is a 150-plus-year-old hotel. It's burned to the ground three times, and it's totally haunted. The evidence that we got is just amazing. But the owner that was there, actually not an owner, but the manager who was there, was real standoffish at first and thought we were a little kind of kooky. And I just carried myself off professionally and said, I'm a scientist and this is what I do, and we take a such and such a way of dealing with things. I was going through with my meter and writing everything down. She came up to me and says, what are you doing? And I said, I baselined everything and basically everything you just said. And all of a sudden, she opens up the bar next door and invites me over and says, would you like to have a drink? And I says, no, I can't, because when I'm investigating, I have to not do that. I can't be taking anything in that could alter my consciousness, none of that.
Right.
And she got a big smile on her face, and then she starts telling me this that really happened. And so it opened her up. And so showing them some professionalism, showing them that you're serious about what you're doing, it really goes a long way. Although I did joke with her. I said, well, why don't you just leave the bar open, and then we'll do a good investigation for you from there. And she said, I can't do that. And then I just said, I'm joshing you. But, hey, we're coming up on four minutes from the hour, and we're going to go ahead and take a short break. We'll kind of wrap up some of our discussion about debunking, and then we're going to get into kind of a free-form discussion about UFOs.
Yay!
Maybe why they're here. And so Kat and I are going to go back and forth and talk that. And if we do have anybody who wants to join the talk line, the number is 646-478-0377. And if you call, we'll put you right on and try to answer any questions you might have about investigations or UFOs. So with that said, let's go ahead and go to the break. After I raise the volume. Here we go.
Thank you.
Yes.
We were on the tail end of our discussion about the wonders of investigating and going through all sorts of things paranormal.
Right.
And some of the things that can happen, you know, when you get out there in the field. And I think we've covered quite a bit of ground.
Right.
I'm going to just read real quickly a set of recommendations from ghosthauntingsuite101.com. Recommendations when debunking cases. And then we'll just have final observations and move on to the UFOs. Case example number one that they talk about are with regard to things that should be really examined carefully are lights. And they say that a common cause of mysterious lights that appear in certain places can be explained as reflections, lights passing from a car, and that in the case of a light they investigated for only a few minutes and only on certain at nights, it, you know, these explanations almost got the best of these investigators. The light in question would appear on the nights immediately before, during, and after a full moon. And after noting that the lights never appeared during storms, the investigators took a closer look at the room in question, speculating it might have had something to do with the light of the moon. And they discovered that when the moon was at its fullest, the light would reflect off the aluminum frame of the window at just the right angle to shine through a small gap in the blinds, thereby projecting the light into a corner of the room. And so, you know, it makes sense that you would, if you were to just stand in front of the blinds, you'd cast a shadow, or you'd see the light cast upon yourself.
Well, you know, Taps debunked in that one theater that light that moved across the ceiling was actually headlights hitting the top of a paint can.
Huh.
In one of their episodes,
I remember that.
You remember
one.
That?
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is along the same lines. Another one that I've actually had happen to me is music. And in one case, an investigator was conducting research in a cemetery and began to hear faint music, which is exactly what happened to me. Standing quietly, the investigator was able to determine the direction of the sound and aimed a flashlight towards it. And after a few moments, a brief reflection flashed, and the investigator began moving towards it. Upon reaching the fence, the investigator shined the flashlight a bit further into a small wooded area and discovered wind chimes hanging in a tree. And the gentle evening breeze had caused the chiming, and the chimes were just far enough away to be heard, but remained out of sight. And as in my case, it was actual music that was picked up on EVP. And when I was doing my analysis, I had totally forgotten about the music that was playing at the house roughly 100 yards away. And suddenly it occurred to me what I was hearing, because I was hearing these sounds in the background. I couldn't quite identify, but they were musical. And so, you know, this kind of thing happens. You'll pick up evidence that in things out there that just boggle you. Finally, sounds. In another example, the living room of a house displayed a shelf of antique dolls. The owner stated that late at night, the sound of a typewriter could be heard coming from somewhere behind the dolls, and the investigator volunteered to spend the night in the living room and listen for the mysterious sounds. Later that night, the investigator followed the sound to its point of origin. The typing sound was actually caused by a toilet tank in the adjoining room refilling at different times during the night due to a slow leak. During the daytime hours, the sound was drowned out by other household activities. So that's just, you know, here we are, another mundane thing. Just little.
Maybe
little
they should just shoot the toilet.
They shoot the toilet. Yeah, that John Death is. Oh, we're going back to that. Oh,
sorry.
My God. So, you know, in closing, you know, my observations are that most of what you'll find out in the field is going to be basically explainable.
It's explainable.
Yeah. It's the 8 out of 10 cases that you'll walk out there, and it'll be really very dead. You'll get no EVPs or just a few, you know, if possible, you'll get a few. I don't know why, but I never seem to get skunked when I do EVPs. I always get something. But it's most of the time you're not going to get good evidence. And when you do get it, it's just all the more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you for your final conclusion and, you know, statement of wisdom.
Well, anytime we go out in the field to we're doing two things. We're trying to find evidence, and we're also doing a great service to the general public who don't do this kind of thing, but are just as, most people I talk to are just as equally fascinated by it. So if I can help somebody feel a little bit more comfortable in their home, then even though I may not get any viable evidence, it was all worth it.
Yeah. And that's the interesting part I find. I think that paranormal investigation, even during the worst days, it's better than the best day at work, you know?
It's still fascinating.
So that said, I think we've covered the debunking topic fairly well. And now we're going to go on to our final feature of the night, which is UFOs, and kind of a free-form discussion. And frankly, you, Miss Cat, live in the shadow of Mount Rainier.
Yes, I do.
And Rainier was where Kenneth Arnold had his famous sighting from his little, I believe he was flying a Piper Cub.
Yes, he
was. On the afternoon of June 24th, 1947, Arnold described the object's shape as resembling a flat saucer or disc.
And he actually saw six of them.
Yeah, he described that their erratic motion as resembling a saucer skipped across the water, and from this the press quickly coined the terms flying saucer. And he said that they were roughly doing, I think, in the thousands of miles an hour. I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page here in case anybody wants to
know. Now, there were some pilots that saw the same thing.
Yeah, and this was just prior to the Roswell crash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're talking a matter of weeks before this happened, and the picture that I'm looking at here with Kenneth has a bat-winged sort of vehicle, which is too different from, I believe, what our friends in Roswell had experienced seeing. And these things were all over the place. They, you know, in the 1940s, they were actually seeing them during World War II, variations of UFOs, you know, known as Foo Fighters, lights that would appear near to or almost collide with planes, aircraft that were, you know, the classic, you know, flying saucer shapes, or these winged contraptions that were going around that were doing amazing speeds. And when you go back in history, these things are showing up even in paintings, and even in caveman art, you know, things going back to, you know, Neanderthal days. It's showing up, shapes like these are showing up in those paintings. People were recording these, you know, ships a long time ago. And, you know, it's just, I think it's interesting that they would be flying around Mount Rainier. I wonder, I guess there is a lot of military bases there, that kind of thing. So they seem to have an affinity for military bases. So,
well, we have McCord and Fort Lewis out here. And they seem to be drawn to the military type land. So I have, since I live here in Washington, we've heard a lot about Mount Rainier, and there's actually been a couple of UFO sightings over Rainier in the last 30-35 years or so. So.
And by the way, Justin, we have, I believe, Vicky is here in the chat room. So a big hello to Vicky. If she's looks like she might have gone. But hello to Vicky, and thank you for listening in to us. But anyway, have you ever seen anything?
Yeah, I have told you about my incident with the bright green light in my bedroom. That was rather frightening. I have no explanation for it at all.
Huh.
Period. I have no idea what that
was. You thought it was alien or UFO related, you think?
I know it was. There's nothing else that I called the police. I had the managers up. We just, nobody could figure it out.
Yeah.
But the strangest thing about that whole incident was the guy that I was seeing way back when, was a very light sleeper and just wouldn't wake up. I was on top of him, shaking him, and he would not wake up.
So you feel it might have been an attempted abduction or something along those lines?
I thought when I turned around and looked down the hallway that I would see those little gray people. I did not know what was going on. I woke up for some reason out of a sound sleep, and the entire bedroom was a vivid lime green color. Neon green, right through the Levalor's blinds were closed. It was coming right through the blinds. The bathroom was green. The walk-in closet was lime green. The whole room was green, but the hallway was dark. It was only coming through the bedroom. It was not coming through anything else.
That's amazing.
And it was making no sound. There was no noise. I got up. And I ran down the hall, and I turned the corner to go out in the living room, and it was dark. You know, there was moonlight and whatever, but I looked at the clock to see what time it was, and then as soon as I hit the knob to go out on the deck, the green light it stopped. I mean, it was weird. I don't know how I know it stopped. I just know that it was gone.
So you were wide awake for all this.
Yeah, and I came back in the house and I looked at the clock again because I'd heard about missing time.
Yeah.
And it had only taken about a minute, so I wasn't missing any time. And I went back down the hall into the bedroom and I called this guy's name out, and he immediately sat up and thought somebody was in the house because he grabbed his gun and got out of bed and asked me what was wrong.
Well, that's I haven't had that happen, although I've seen a few things I couldn't explain.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
Because I've been doing research on UFOs for a long time because it's just fascinating. And you know, I'd read about people missing time, and I'd read about sleep paralysis, and, you know, the only thing that I can really tell you that's tangible is this individual was a very light sleeper, and you could say his name, and he'd wake up, and I was literally on top of him, bouncing, shaking him, trying to get him to wake up, and he wouldn't move.
Wow.
I thought that I was going to be abducted, but I wasn't sure. I just woke up out of a dead sleep to a lime green room. It was just, and it was silent.
I think that's been going on for, you know, quite a bit of human history. I think that we've been under some sort of a monitoring program of some sort. You know, they obviously are getting an interest in our biology, or they're doing things that we could not possibly fathom. I mean, there has to be a purpose. That's why I brought up the show tonight, you know, the last half hour, was what is their mission? Why are they here? You know, what possible reason could they find to drop in on humanity who's, you know, on the third, you know, rim outer edge of the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, one of 400 billion stars? What possible reason could they be here for?
Well, you know, I think they've been here for
30 years.
They've been here for centuries, though.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched this for 30 years now, and I've seen what I believe to be advanced, you know, prototype U.S. military aircraft that I had never seen before. Twice I've seen triangular shaped craft that are flying right over Shingle Springs that were definitely not the B-2 Spirit, because you know, I know exactly what those look like. I'm very familiar with them, and these things were big. I mean, really big.
And they're silent.
Well, I heard what sounded to me like a pulsing sound. It was unlike any other jet I've ever heard. So
really?
I couldn't quite call it a UFO, but I thought, you know, that's got to be one of ours. But what is this one of ours? And it was heading in the direction of a known base here in California that had hosted some of the prior military aircraft that were extremely high speed, shall we say. I won't
right.
go into all of that. I think let's just go ahead and say it, the SR-71. But I've also seen, and I watched this for a period of right around 3 months, right about 1994, 95 time frame, I would go out and look on the deck of my little studio, and to the north I would watch an aircraft crisscrossing the sky back and forth, and then he'd come out about an hour later and it'd be crosshatching the sky, the north and south. And from the east and west it would go, and then to the north and south. And so this thing was like driving like you would mow a lawn. And whenever this thing would appear, for the next 4 or 5 days, the skies would be this cloudy, overcast, and it would just stay that way. And Art Bell had been on talking about it quite a bit, about the potential that this was, you know, an Air Force experiment.
You think it was dropping some kind of contrails or something that stuck around?
Oh, I'm pretty sure that they had an advanced prototype material that was being used to, that had a long life to stay in the atmosphere, and the ability to basically screen an area from satellites, which would be if I were in the military, I would do that. And the reason I would be because if you're going to go put, you know, troops in theater, that's a great tool for doing it. You're just going to go in and put a big shield over the top. Nobody can see anything. Kind of blinds you from your own forces. It's got issues, but that said, it's definitely a great tool. So some of these things I think are going to be, by and large, as we said earlier with the paranormal stuff, most of the time it's explainable. But there are those things that, you know, for example, someone very close to me described a sighting in Lincoln, California in the 50s, where the entire town was threatened within an inch of their lives, not to talk about it, but there used to be a missile base. And it was one of the, I think, second or third strings of defense for the country when we were, you know, against the Red Menace. And these things would show up and scare the dickens out of the entire town. And they would, it was a cigar-shaped craft with portals that you could see what looked to be humanoid shapes in the windows.
Really?
And all of the ranches around the area, including my, you know, it was basically a member of my family, told me the story, that they would see these things in the windows, and it would it basically cruised along the tree lines and was always within sight of this silo that everybody knew was there but no one talked about. And for quite a few years, it was a good 5 or 6 years, this thing was sighted regularly. And my mother, well, I'll just say it, my mother witnessed it, but it was one of those things that you just could not, you would be sitting there and all of a sudden the animals would go crazy. And then what would happen after that point would be the sound. They would hear this kind of a humming sound. And everyone would run out and look, and here's this thing going, you know, through the sky. But no one dared say a thing because they would be labeled. And
wow.
These things were going unchallenged through restricted military airspace. So, you know, this is a pattern that has, you see all through ufology. It's just over and over again this kind of thing shows up. So when they took eventually it came to pass that they took this missile out of its silo and deactivated the facility, and like a light switch, these things stopped happening. And this story repeats itself over and over again throughout not only our installations, but, you know, for example, stories that come out of Russia from the Kapustin Yar, which is their equivalent of Area 51 here, and other Soviet, you know, bases. There's story after story comes out, you know, that leaked out from behind the Iron Curtain and all and on right into the current day of these very same sorts of things. So one of the prerequisites seems to be, for modern day sightings at least, is military activity, you know, military base, especially the more sensitive ones, tend to attract these things. You know,
has anybody ever seen these men in black? They seem to follow these mass sightings where people might talk about what they saw, and there's wide report of these pasty-faced looking robot men in black people.
Yeah, I've read quite a bit about them, and they do seem to show up not long after the Roswell incident, and I have a feeling it's probably going to be more mundane activity in some, you know, from a human standpoint, in some cases, but there's been an awful lot of conjecture that maybe some of them are involved in this too, that some form of alien activity is happening on the planet. And I'm inclined to believe that it's a gray area. I think it's a little bit of both. And the reason I say that is because there's just so many cases of people who are experienced military, experienced intelligence folks who have come out years later or on a deathbed confession who've said that, well, that wasn't us and it's nothing that we would have been doing. And some of the looks on these faces, just like you say, these people have pasty faces. They don't look quite right.
Well, I thought, seriously, that this experience I had was about 13 years ago. And I seriously thought that I would see these men in black.
Well, the thing that I think that really defines a men in black case is when you have a sighting and it's a mass sighting, or you have a sighting that seems to carry some sort of weight for some reason, where there was somebody took pictures, somebody was out with a mass media outlet capability or whatever, and was broadcasting information about these things when really no one in whatever agency or whatever group wanted that out there. And, if that's conventional U.S. military or U.S. intelligence, then great, more power to them. That's their business.
I wonder how come none of the cops that have ever seen these things have never reported seeing the men in black.
I don't think that's quote a never. I think that we could probably find some evidence on that. Matter of fact, I think for the next show we ought to bring some of this in, is probably for our first half hour. Just kind of go over that. I think that's a great carry-on, because we're coming up on the 6 minutes towards the end of the show here.
Okay.
But I do think, that these things warrant a lot more talk and a lot more investigation, on the part of people. And paranormal investigators, at least need to be aware of this stuff, because a lot of the techniques that we do are the same as what ufologists all do. And I can see we have a new guest on the line, guest 4172. Oh, my goodness. Hello, guest 4172. Anyway, I think that there is activity that is, that people are visiting the Earth who are not human. I think that they have a variety of missions. I don't think that it's any one race in particular. I think there's a variety, And yours is the first case where I've heard of a lime green light happening.
Oh, it was crazy.
Yeah, and I think that it would be interesting to see if there are any cases like yours out there that maybe are coincidental, and especially in your area, who knows? Have you ever thought about that, looking into that?
Well, we're only 40 miles from Mount Rainier, so if that ties in with Mount Rainier, then, I've never actually thought about finding anybody who has had a similar experience, though I did research it online for a while. I've never come across this lime green color, but I know that it was blinding.
Well, I think that that's something to probably check into. The whole phenomenon, I think, is just rife with story after story that's similar, and yet you run into these unique things. Cases of crashes, cases where, our own government and even the Russian government has shot these things down. You wonder sometimes if some of the paranormal things that go on are somehow related. And, here's a thought. What about some of the crashes of some of these creatures whose spirits might roam the earth and haven't been able to get off because they don't know they're dead? Now, imagine that.
Do they have spirits, I wonder?
Well, I'm sure they would. I mean, if the universe is made up of the same elements across, billions and billions of light years, I'm certain that, if we have spirits and walk the earth the way we do, I would tend to believe that they probably would. It seems a reasonable stretch that there would be spirits in some of these beings, and perhaps even a sense of humor. Who knows? Oh, I don't know. Maybe they, Maybe we should go build ships and we can abduct some of them and find out, right?
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. If anybody can do it, you and I can do it.
That would be the case. We need a battle plan, but we can muster one of those in just a few hours.
Well, working in the business of making things going really fast like I do, I can tell you reliably that I think we're a ways off from that. So, you know, in our lifetime, I would love to see it, but I really think I'm going to be an old guy retired with my chair in front of me going, hey, it's time for another GRI installment. So I think we're coming up. We're in the last couple of minutes in the show. And, hey, I just want to thank you for coming on every week with me and being my sidekick.
Yeah, it's me.
Yeah, that's you, all right.
I'm just a sidekick.
No, you're not just a sidekick.
You know, since we only have a few minutes left, I just wanted to let everybody know that our special Valentine's Day show, I will be live in the studio down in Shingle Springs, California, and our special guest will be none other than Alan Rupnick from the I Am Haunted website.
Yeah, it was really gracious of him to come on, and we're going to have quite a show. And I tend to think that it's going to just be really neat to see you for once, actually here in our studio. So drive safe coming down, darling, because it's a long drive from Seattle all the way here near Sacramento.
It's not so bad when you drive a bullet.
Yeah, we both drive Mustangs. And
The GRI Mustangs,
yep,
will prevail.
Darn straight. You know, I've got the red one, and you've got the somewhat light, I wouldn't say bluish, but kind of charcoal.
It's called tungsten.
Tungsten. Oh, what a...
It's a light gray color with purple fleck in it. It's beautiful.
Well, so you'll appear to be a UFO as you drive down the road then.
That's right.
Okay, well, we're on the last 30 seconds of the stretch here.
All right.
So, you know, we'll be back once again here next week, and I do not have my show notes in front of me for next week, but I'm sure it's going to be a great show. And tune in again when we come in. Kat and I are going to have something interesting to say, and I think we'll talk about the UFO question more. Okay, so with that, we're down to the last 10 seconds, so thank you and have a great time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Well, hey, I'll hang up here, and then because we're still recording, and then I'll just I'm gonna go check on my dad. And
okay.
There's some stuff going on, so I'll give you a call in a little while. Okay.
All right.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.